Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Kate Young.
There's kind of this deeper level of change that can happen if you take your kids out to the grocery store and you say, we're going to spend $25 on food for other people, and I want you to think about things that other people might like and keep in mind the kinds of things that you like because other people are like you.
Today on our show, we talk about holiday giving and food drives with Amanda Nicky of Mother Hubbard's Cupboard, a food pantry in Bloomington, Indiana. Harvest Public Media brings us a story on wind energy innovation in the face of federal funding cuts. And Daniel Orr shows us how to handle a pomegranate and shares a Palestinian recipe featuring those sparkling red jewels. That's all coming up after the news. Hi, Mark. Welcome back after a week off. What have you got for us today?
Hey, Kate. Good to be back. First up, there's more bad news for rural America. Harvest Public Media's Peggy Lowe explains what the U.S. Department of Agriculture's annual survey found.
Population is still going down, the Great Recession rebound is slow, and poverty remains a persistent problem. Those findings weren't surprising, says the USDA's John Cromartie. What was unexpected? Higher mortality rates in working-age adults.
There are several interrelated factors that have contributed to this trend, including the rise in prescription medication abuse, especially opioids, and the more recent related rise in heroin overdose deaths.
Cromartie says the only rural counties gaining population are in the West, where there is a significant oil and gas industry presence or scenic and recreation-based economies. Peggy Lowe, Harvest Public Media.
And news from the food industry. The Grocery Manufacturers Association has long served as one of the food industry's biggest and most powerful mouthpieces in Washington. But over the last few months, several companies have broken ranks. Campbell's Soup Company and Nestle announced earlier this year they would leave the GMA. And now the largest dairy company in the U.S., Dean Foods, has also decided to leave, according to Politico. Politico also reports that Mars and other companies are considering an exit. The departures of Nestle and Campbell's follow a battle over mandatory labeling of genetically modified foods. GMA opposed the idea. Campbell's and Nestle were in favor. Other divides in the food industry include delays on when new nutrition facts labels would take effect. The White House gave the GMA and other food lobbyists an 18-month extension on those rules earlier this year. But Coca-Cola notably sided with those who wanted to see the labels rolled out earlier. This all comes as big food companies are losing market share in the U.S. Credit Suisse reported last year that the top 20 food and beverage companies lost a combined $18 billion between 2011 and 2017. That trend is driven in part by a growing demand for organic produce, less processed foods, and fewer chemicals. And federal regulators are taking issue with the World Health Organization's suggestions on how to limit antibiotics given to livestock. Grant Gerlach of Harvest Public Media explains what the disagreement could mean for farm exports.
Giving fewer antibiotics to animals is thought to be a way to protect humans from drug-resistant diseases like salmonella. The United Nations Public Health Agency recently said farmers should only use antibiotics when cattle, hogs, and poultry are sick, not as a preventive measure. Federal policy still allows preventive antibiotic use, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Food and Drug Administration say the science doesn't support changing that. The WHO has no bearing on U.S. regulations, but Michigan State University law professor Neil Fortin says it can influence the International Food Code, which keeps countries from setting up tariffs under the guise of food safety.
Under the World Trade Organization, they're considered the minimum standard.
When the food code matches U.S. policy, it can help keep more doors open for exports. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Our news stories come to us today from Chad Bouchard and our partners over at Harvest Public Media, a reporting collaboration focused on food and agriculture.
Thank you, Mark Chilla.
You bet, Kate.
Wind is a big part of the country's energy portfolio. In some places, it's vital. parts of the Midwest and Great Plains have led the way, but with a chill around federal funding for renewable energy, researchers are increasingly turning to energy partners to bring the next generation of innovation to the marketplace. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports.
So this is a short-eared owl.
Anupam Sharma is showing me the wing of an owl. He's an aerospace engineering professor at Iowa State University.
That's the comb edge. So what you'll find...
When an owl flies through the air, it makes very little noise. Sharma's taking inspiration from the comb-like structure on the owl's wing feathers to engineer a quieter wind turbine.
Wind turbines are very, very quiet. They do not produce a lot of noise.
But he says they are usually located in places with almost no noise. Sometimes the noise the turbines do create bothers people, which can lead to challenges for the companies installing them and the communities attracted to the tax revenue they bring.
So given all that, we realize that noise is a problem. And if you can bring the noise down, it will appease all those people who have these issues.
Sharma recently received a $500,000 grant from the National Science Foundation and additional support from the state of Iowa. The grants are critical because a Department of Energy program that previously funded his work is no longer an option.
That program has basically shut down. They shut down for wind, I should say. They very clearly state that they're not going to fund anything in wind anymore.
Wind once received the lion's share of Department of Energy funds for renewable energy. Now, wind generation is a relatively mature industry. In fact, even with a federal budget proposal that would bring even less support, the industry is poised for growth. Take MidAmerican Energy Company, which has more than 750,000 customers in Iowa, South Dakota, and Illinois. As recently as 2003, it didn't use wind power to generate any of its electricity.
We expect to be at about 56% in 2017.
That's Vice President for Resource Development Michael Fair. He says by 2021, their goal is 95%. Fair says it's not just Iowa's natural wind resource that's allowed the state to become a leader.
There's a lot of factors that play into it. One of them definitely is Iowa has always had strong bipartisan support for renewable energy.
Kansas, the Dakotas, and Oklahoma have also been wind generation leaders. In 2019, a big tax credit for generating wind power will sunset. The American Wind Energy Association's John Hensley says that has companies looking to an independent future.
We're striving to continue to drive these costs out of the turbines and the energy that we produce so that when those tax credits do go away, we are able to stand on our own 2 feet and move forward as an industry.
He says private businesses will increasingly need to fund research and development.
We're seeing companies pick up internally a lot of the R&D efforts that were previously provided by some of these government entities.
That's something another Iowa State engineering professor is counting on.
In the field, you will then connect column panel to create what I call a cell.
And Sri Sridharan points to pieces that can be assembled into a hexcrete tower. They're built from special high-performing concrete and assembled in a hexagonal shape. He says they could be a cost-effective way for the next generation of wind towers to stretch taller than the existing standard of 80 meters.
If you can go up to 120, 140 meters, you can actually produce wind in all 50 states. That's a huge benefit because some states don't even have any renewable capacity right now.
Sridharan recently completed a $1.2 million project funded largely through the Department of Energy. Part of it required him to engage industry partners.
And several companies said they're interested. And they said they will be interested in working with us to continue.
He'll need that support as he takes his project through certification and prototyping, most likely without any additional federal dollars. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
And you'll find some great photos from this story of the owl's wing design and the Hex Creek Tower. That's on our website, eartheats.org. And you can find more stories from rural America on harvestpublicmedia.org. Sometimes the most elegant desserts are also the most simple. That's definitely true with this recipe from Chef Daniel Orr. You might hear it called basbousa. You might hear it called harissa. I call it delicious. Let's hear how it's done.
We try to do a little bit for everyone on Earth Eats. And so we've celebrated lots of different holidays. Today we're going to celebrate a Palestinian holiday by doing a harissa. Okay, and that is a toasted semolina cake, and it's really delicious, simple and elegant. Starts with a cake, and then it's finished with a orange flower syrup on top of it. And we're going to serve ours with some pomegranates and a little bit of yogurt today. All right, so we have the toasted semolina. Now, semolina is a coarse ground wheat. Okay, and this is toasted, so you can see it's got kind of some brown and different colored grains to it. To that, we're going to add our sugar, and we have about 3/4 cups. Again, as always, we have our recipes posted online at eartheats.org. We're also going to use some coconut flour, and this you can find at a lot of health food stores. It's a way just to cut down a little bit on the wheat, and it's made from when they extract the coconut milk and the fats from the coconut. What's left is a product that's coconut flour. And you can use that for baking if you want to do gluten-free. It adds a little more fat, a little more texture to anything that you're baking. We're going to add some melted butter. We got 3/4 cups. And we're going to add some yogurt. This is a whole fat yogurt. We're adding 1 full cup of that. To that, we're going to add some baking powder. We have 1.5 teaspoons. And we're going to mix that with our hands. We just want that all to come together. The baking powder is going to give it a little bit of leavener, so it will lighten it up a little bit. But you can see it's very simple. There are no eggs in this cake. And you just want to really make sure that everything's incorporated. I'm also going to add a pinch of salt and a little pinch of pepper. Okay, I like to put a little salt and pepper in all of my desserts, even my ice creams, because what it does, even if you can't taste it, it opens up a different part of your tongue so you can taste other flavors. Okay, so you can see that that's a nice mix. Okay, I'm going to take a baking pan. And instead of, you know, traditionally in America, we would use, we would butter a pan. But I'm going to use tahini. And tahini is a sesame seed paste. So it's interesting how different parts of the world use different ingredients to do the same thing. But this is also going to give us a little different flavor, too. We're going to want to make sure that goes up the pan, side of the pan a bit. Pour in that semolina mix. And we're going to pat it down to a uniform thickness, probably of about 1/2 inch. And you want to have it very consistent, so I'm going to tap it. That's going to make it flatten out. And then I'm going to cut it into diamonds.
Are you cutting all the way through there or just scoring?
Just kind of scoring it, and then when I take it out of the oven, I'll cut it the rest of the way through. But what I want to do is to make places to put my almonds. So then I take an almond and I pat an almond down in each one of those little diamonds. You could also, if you wanted to, instead of using coconut flour, you could use almond flour or ground almonds. That would be a nice change. And you could also, if you want to do gluten-free, you could replace the semolina with cornmeal, some coarse cornmeal. So this probably takes the longest of any part of this dish, is putting these almonds on all these dang little squares. But it really looks nice. So we're going to put this in the oven for about 30 to 45 minutes. It's going to be a 350 degree oven. If it starts to brown too much, we're going to turn it down a little bit to 300 and finish it, make sure that it's cooked all the way through.
You'll have it in the oven for about 30 to 45 minutes. And while the cake bakes, we make the orange blossom syrup.
What we're going to do is, once that comes out, while it's still warm, we're going to pour a nice orange flower syrup over it. You could also use rose water if you wanted to do a rose syrup. Both are very, very nice. Both are very traditional throughout the whole region and even all the way up into Persia. So what we're going to do is we're going to pour the water in the saucepan. We're going to add about 2.5 cups of sugar. We're going to add the orange flower water. We're also going to add some lemon zest and lemon juice. Okay, bring that to a boil and then set aside and let it come down to room temperature.
Once the cake is baked, remove it from the oven.
Bring it out. We're going to pour that syrup on top of it and let it soak in. Now we've taken a knife and we've run through those lines that we drew on there, made sure that they went all the way through to the bottom of the pan. Now we're going to take out one of those nice squares and serve it with a little bit of yogurt on top and some pomegranate. And there's our Palestinian semolina cake.
I've never tasted a cake like this before. The texture is almost sandy, and saturated in that fragrant syrup. And that toasted semolina gives it a nutty flavor. You gotta try it. So simple, as you'll see when you go to our website for the recipe, eartheats.org. Support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personal financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com. This time of year, in communities across the country, schools and businesses will be collecting cans for food drives. It's an American tradition during the holidays to balance feast planning and shopping trips with plans to help others and to share that good fortune with those experiencing hard times. In recent years, though, I've come across some criticism of the food drive approach as an inefficient method for getting food to people who need it. All those cans need to be checked and sorted. Plus, agencies can obtain more food for less money through the food banking system. So individuals paying retail for food is a waste of money. It's better, the argument goes, to give money directly to trusted organizations. Amanda Nicky is the president and CEO of Mother Hubbard's Cupboard, a food pantry and community food resource center in Bloomington, Indiana. I sat down with her in our studio this week for her thoughts on holiday food drives. Many people do feel inspired to run a food drive, either at their place of business or at a school, just gathering up those canned goods and non-perishables and bringing them into the food bank or the food pantry. Is this the best approach if people really want to have an impact?
I think it depends. I think the answer can be yes. If there's intention on the kinds of foods that you're collecting, so there's kind of this deeper level of change that can happen if you take your kids out to the grocery store and you say, we're going to spend $25 on food for other people, and I want you to think about things that other people might like and keep in mind the kinds of things that you like because other people are like you. I think there's a really good lesson there to be learned. And that has an impact on you, it has an impact on your children, it has an impact on the people they might talk about that experience with. It'll have an impact on their children when they remember that experience and want to recreate that for their own kids. It might make them think about people who are different or people who have less than they do in a way that's more humanizing. So I think that, yes, food drives have their place. But if we're talking in terms of just efficiency, you know, for a pantry of our size that's serving, you know, thousands of people a week, a handful of cans is, you know, kind of a drop in the bucket in terms of the amount of food that we're putting out. And because of our relationship with our local food bank, we're able to, you know, leverage a dollar to get many more pounds of food than one individual might be able to do at the grocery store. So I think there are a couple of ways to look at that question, a couple of ways to answer that question, and it kind of really depends on what your goal is.
I asked Nikki, let's say the goal is to get the most bang for your buck. Is it better to give money to organizations like hers to purchase food through the food bank, or should people buy food at the grocery store and donate it to a food drive?
And I'll clarify that we don't purchase the food from the food bank. We are able to get more food for a dollar than most people are. We pay a shared maintenance charge to the food bank for certain items that are in their warehouse. And a lot of the fresh food and healthier foods we actually get for free. So I think people can also think about, in terms of supporting organizations like Mother Hubbard's Cupboard or other organizations in town that are providing emergency food services, think beyond just the food. Think about the people who are putting it on the shelves, the people who are sorting it, the people who are preparing it in the kitchens, the staff time that goes into doing all of that work, the rent or mortgage payments that we might have for our facilities, the utilities. You know, we have to have heat. We need electricity. Those are expenses that are just as important for people to think about and to support. That just the food items alone, they don't happen on their own. They're, you know, if you give us a can of green beans or a can of tomatoes, it's not making it out on that shelf by itself. There's a lot of things that have to happen behind the scenes for the programs to run.
We talked about the importance of retaining skilled staff to carry out the programming. And Nikki said she didn't want her employees to need to use the food pantry services that they're providing.
As the leader of the organization, it's important to me that our staff is adequately compensated. And so fair wages are something that we strive for, and it's part of our strategic plan. We want employees to feel supported and taken care of. There's a difference between providing efficient services and being fair to our employees and providing efficient services kind of on the backs of our employees.
Nikki talked about how efficiency isn't the only thing to consider when it comes to holiday giving.
We have models for food drives that we share with people who are interested in running a food drive for us. And some of what we talk about is just the joy that can be found in a special food, you know, just some kind of treat that when you are really making decisions about whether you can afford food or gas this week, that might do more than just kind of feed your body. Having access to something that's special or a treat might really just help you mentally, help you get through the day. You know, I like chocolate. It helps me get through the day. And so being able to have food that can be joyful is really important.
Yeah, I think some of the criticism that I've seen around food drives has been, oh, so you're just emptying out your cupboards of the things that you know you're never going to eat. Can of green beans that's been stuck at the back of the cupboard gathering dust. And that what you're suggesting is, why don't you actually think about the people who are receiving it, not just what's your extra thing that you're not going to use.
Right, and use it as an opportunity or a practice to think about others for that time, and not necessarily just thinking about how it makes you feel or clearing up the space in your cabinets or whatever, or feeling better about the food that you didn't eat and now it's not going to go to waste. Be intentional and think about the recipients.
That was Amanda Nikki of Mother Hubbard's Cupboard. I also spoke with Nikki and her colleague Stephanie Solomon about the importance of challenging dominant narratives around hunger. We'll have more from our conversation in the coming weeks on Earth Eats. Pomegranates start showing up in the grocery stores in the fall, and you can usually find them through the winter. Lucky for us, they're a beautiful fruit and seem especially suited for the holidays with those sparkling scarlet seeds. I use them to liven up a kale salad or garnish a dessert. And that's how Daniel Orr is going to use them today, sprinkled on top of a dollop of yogurt on that toasted semolina cake. But if you haven't worked with a pomegranate, they can be a bit baffling. How are you supposed to get to the good part? The good part, of course, is the shiny red kernels, also known as arils. That's A-R-I-L-S, arils. And they're covered in a leathery, muted red peel with random sections of white, pithy skin on the inside. Well, I can tell you it's easier than it looks if you know a few tricks. Chef Daniel Orr walks us through the process.
Pomegranates are a seasonal fruit, especially in the United States. You'll find them a lot in the Middle East and in Mexico and Central America. I'm going to show you two different ways to enjoy a pomegranate. First way is to enjoy the kernels. So I'm going to cut it in half, east to west.
Picture the pomegranate like a globe, with the stem and blossom ends as the north and south poles. You'll want to cut along the equator.
And expose the interior. And then what I'm going to do is to take a nice heavy spoon, and I'm going to whack the back of the pomegranate. And you can see all the kernels come right out. So you can see in a matter of really seconds, I've got completely clean pomegranate.
It's quite miraculous, really. The arils just fall from the skin, leaving all that bitter pith behind. And it's fast.
Pomegranates are known to have lots of antioxidants. Of course, everybody hears of pomegranate juice. And you can make pomegranate juice at home. And what you would do is you would do the same thing I just did, cut it in half east to west, and then put it in a citrus juicer and just squeeze it, and you'll get the pomegranate juice. The last way I'm going to show you is to cut it so you can eat it out of hand. So I'm going to cut off the top and bottom, and you can see that there are about six little areas, like separations like in a grapefruit.
Okay, so earlier I described the sections as random, but I can see now it's really quite organized in there.
Okay, what I'm going to do is cut down each of those wherever those white lines are.
So you're just sort of scoring the outer skin.
Scoring it wherever those white lines are.
So he's cut the fruit in half around the equator, if you will, and you can see the marked sections. So now he's scoring the peel, starting at those section marks and moving towards the stem or blossom end.
Now I'm just going to peel it, and I'm just going to take the exterior peel off, and what you end up with is the peeled pomegranate. And then I'm just going to cut it,
open it up,
and then you can break it off into your little pieces and take off any of the little white pith, and then you have perfectly peeled and ready to eat pomegranate pieces.
Yeah, so then you would just
pick this up and just eat them right off like that.
This second method is a bit more involved, but results in some nice clusters that you can either eat out of hand, like Chef Daniel Orr, or you can arrange them on a plate. The first method is much quicker, and you end up with the singular pomegranate arils, perfect for our garnish. And those shimmering gems really are striking against the white yogurt and the golden semolina cake. And it's not just for decoration. The tangy burst of flavor is the perfect contrast to creamy and sandy. See all the photos on our website, eartheats.org. Support for Earth Eats comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. NeedMoreRoasters.com. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. I want to thank all the Earth Eats people. That's Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, Farm Bloomington Restaurant, our partners at Harvest Public Media, and Indiana University Food Institute. Our executive producer is John Bailey. This is Kate Young. Thanks for listening to Earth Eats. See you next week.